This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. We're talking to a man in Sing Sing Prison. His name is John J. Lennon. You were locked up for murder. You murdered a fellow drug dealer. Is that right, John?
Yes, sir.
The reason we're talking to you is because you have become a writer, which I know is not new. We've had prison writers before. But what you've done in your latest article in Esquire magazine is give us an insight into what happens behind bars, and in particular, the large number of people incarcerated who are mentally ill. So the percentage is something like, you write that about 400,000 of the 2.2 million prisoners have a psychiatric diagnosis. Can you give us a, in the brief time we have, a feel for what happens to people like this when they're incarcerated in places like, well, you were in Attica for a while and now Sing Sing. What happens to people with mental illness?
Well, they fall through the cracks of the prison system. They do different time than, say, the sort of prison time that I do. I think I try to juxtapose my prison time to, say, Joe Cardo's prison time that I wrote about in the Esquire piece. They have difficulties with anything from saying where they want to go when the officer makes his rounds. It amounts to all sorts of problems that they'll have. They get picked on a lot, depending on the severity of their mental illness. It's a motley of issues that they'll come up against.
Are they getting any treatment?
Well, yes. I mean, I work on a unit where the OMH, that's the Office of Mental Health, and they do treat them with groups, and I'm actually an assistant here at Sing Sing. They didn't have that at Attica, so actually I'm grateful that I could actually work up on the unit. So they'll have groups. They'll have different types of cognitive sort of groups. They have a computer lab where they could practice different programs. And recently I started a creative writing workshop. And there's different stuff that the social workers and doctors do. But it's not a hospital. It's a prison. And at the end of the day, there's this conflict that's always happening between the counselors and the guards, the correction officers. And that's the problem with treating the people with mental illness in prison.
You talked about how Ronald Reagan neglected to follow through on mental health reform that Jimmy Carter has started. And as a result, instead of having mental institutions, which had grown corrupt and dysfunctional, we ended up turning a lot of these people back into the streets, which has resulted in the homeless problem that we see in Seattle and so many other cities. You think it's time to try the mental institution approach again?
I mean, it's not the panacea. It's a combination of that. But yes, I do think there needs to be more sort of traditional mental health hospitals, psychiatric centers. Sure, yeah. But there also just needs to be more funding on certain community programs that are already in operation in different states. So to answer your question, no, I don't think let's build up all the asylums again and put everybody back there. Because the whole reason why they were sort of downsized in the 50s and 60s was because there was advancements made on a lot of psychiatric medications and et cetera. So I think we need to have a revamping of the whole how we treat people with mental illness in America in conjunction with the criminal justice system that's where they're all at. Look, I think there needs to be a front-end sort of thing that we address. We need to have more mental illness courts so prosecutors aren't, like, you know, fist-pumping, looking for convictions with you know, a poor guy that's barely holding on by a thread. And then on the back end, when they're in prison, look, some people with mental illness aren't going to come to prison because some commit crimes. That's the central problem. But on the back end, when they're in prison, there needs to be more actual hospital-like setups in the prison system. But again, I'm not a policymaker or a legislator. I'm a guy that tells stories from the inside. I think my job as a journalist is to give the reader a glimpse of what this life is for guys like Joe Cardo and many more on the inside.
Well, of course, we're now in a big debate about prison reform. We have 2.2 million prisoners. There doesn't seem to be much hope among people who look at it from the outside of effective rehabilitation. You have so many people who get out of prison, but because of their record, they can't get jobs. I mean, we haven't corrected people, it seems to me. We've created this underclass that will suffer from permanent unemployment. People will distrust whether they have really reformed or not. I mean, you sound like a a regular person to me, even though you committed murder. I'm not going to go into the details. You can read about that in the Esquire article. But, I mean, for example, you're not out until, let's see, 2029. Is there some reason, I mean, just be honest with me, are you still a dangerous person? Is there some reason that you couldn't be released now and come back into society and hold a job and pay taxes?
No, I think I would do quite well if I was released into society. I mean, I've learned to write well and to have built quite a network for myself. I think I would do fine if I was released. But I think, you know, that's the problem. It's not really, you know, this is not about me getting released. I mean, I think I'd do okay if I got out. I think that's what, on a larger issue, what this is all about, right? This is all about how do we grapple as a society with wanting to punish people who are, at the end of the day, when I'm talking about people with mental illness, very, very sick people.
Yeah.
I work every day in this unit that I told you about before. So you've heard of Kendra's Law, right? This is sort of rippled through America, right? This horrible crime 20 years ago, Andrew Goldstein pushed a journalist, pushed her into the train tracks. This guy was suffering from schizophrenia, and people were out for blood. They wanted, this guy needs to go to jail. I mean, this guy is like oozing schizophrenia.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward 20 years, and now he's on the unit that I work that's prepping him for release. So now he's getting out.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you, like, he's taking his medication, he's following the rules, he doesn't get misbehavior reports, but I mean by you, the society wanted punishment. So, well, that's what you got. You got 20 years of prison, now he's getting out, and you see the shape of the guy. I bet you would have traded that off for treatment. But that's what we want here in America. We want to punish people that are very, very sick. And you know, he'll be getting out in September, and hopefully he'll be okay. I think the larger point is this man has been tormented for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he shuffles in his cell with burnt fingertips because he smokes cigarettes down to his thumbnail. He has no TV. He has no nothing. He has holes in his sneakers that are issued by the state, and he's filthy. And that's who's going to be shuffling out of the prison in a couple months. I mean, this is what we got.
That doesn't sound like a good idea to me.
It's just a sad story.
Well, I mean, is it safe? Are you saying it's not safe to release him?
No, I'm not saying that. Yeah. I'm saying that's not my call. I mean, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that you put somebody in prison with schizophrenia. I mean, he does receive treatment here, but he probably would have got better treatment in the hospital for the past 20 years. I mean, he struggles. I'm just explaining the way he lives.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he takes his medication. He doesn't have impulse issues like that anymore, but he's just, he struggles here in prison, and that's the punishment that I think that we wanted. So I think the question was about punishment and treatment and, you know, what is appropriate. It's not my place to say whether he can be released with, and he's going to be released, not just thrusted back into society. He's going to be released. New York has sort of programs set up where he's going to be observed. He's going to be assisted with housing. He's going to be a phone call away from a caseworker that will assist him with housing, shopping initially, with making appointments, etc.
Okay, no, that's good. That sounds reasonable, and it sounds fair. But in order to prevent that kind of thing, it sounds like you're saying that his illness should have been identified earlier, and he should have been put into treatment. I think one of the problems is that, though, sometimes people refuse treatment. And it used to be you could involuntarily commit them to some sort of treatment, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this issue has many layers. I mean, I'm not, you know, in a position to say, you know, what we should go back to in that. In that arena, I think there are much smarter people than me that can make that assessment. But I can only give you in the form of story what life is like in prison for some of these guys.
But can I ask you for your advice then? And I appreciate you want to be a writer and don't want to maybe don't want to take a stand on these things. But I get the sense from talking to you and frankly from reading the stories of other prisoners who have been released that in our thirst for punishment, we hold people longer than we need to. We hold people long after they have been reformed. And I notice we have a president now who seems to like the idea of pardoning people. From your experience on the inside, all the men that you've met there, are there people who could be released significantly before their term is up and could go on to lead productive lives, thereby saving their lives, I mean, allowing them to make something of themselves and saving us a lot of money?
Yeah, so we're shifting into a clemency conversation.
Yes.
Absolutely. I do believe today, like for example, so I'm in Sing Sing. I'm in one of the most progressive prisons in America. I think San Quentin is another progressive prison on your side of the country over there. But there's a few in between, but most are punitive. But I'll tell you a little bit about what we've been doing here and what guys have opportunities for here in Sing Sing. So yesterday, men graduated with bachelor's degrees here from a program called from Mercy College. It's funded by Doris Buffett and a few others from an organization called Hudson Link Higher Education. Sing Sing also has a master's program, the New York Theological Seminary. I'm writing a piece. Guys are graduating next week. I'm writing a piece about these guys. These guys have a less than 0% recidivism rate. So it's like these guys get their act together. Like, if mm-hmm. they get out, then they're not coming back. So sure, to answer your question, if clemency was used a lot more in the 60s, I mean, even back when Rachel Barkow and a lot of these professors that are specialists on this have written law reviews about comparing how clemency was really used back in the 60s and even before that, even up until the Reagan era that you mentioned. Reagan, he used it a lot more. But yeah, so the pendulum is swinging back now. As you know, after the 80s and 90s and 2000s, it was a very punitive time. It was the crack era. It was a lot of crime. It was really hard for people to digest. They didn't know really what to do. But here we are, right? So I guess to answer your question, yeah, clemency is the executive branch's way to say, you know, enough already. Like, let's see some of these guys that, and gals, heck. I mean, the woman that was released, I mean, I'm not a big fan of Trump's, but I mean, he seemed to make the right call there. So, I mean, I think they're getting the memo that, sure, that is an option to sort of lessen the bill on society for people that actually can be released and like you say, be law-abiding citizens and pay taxes. I intend to do a lot more than that, you know, if I get out. But I mean, I get your point, and I agree with it.
Now, let me ask you, because this is a question on a lot of people's minds, too. We've talked about the mental illness side, and I think most of us get that treatment would be better than incarceration. For people who are not mentally ill, who were of completely sound mind and body when they committed their crimes, as you did, you used, basically executed a drug dealer who was infringing on your turf with an M16. You rented the car, you planned the whole thing, you dumped the body in Sheepshead Bay. I want to know if there's any law that society could have passed, whether it was, a gun law, anti-gang law, drug enforcement, whatever, that would have stopped you from committing that crime.
No. No, there's no. It's not about. I mean, I think we know this from the studies with the death penalty, where certain states have death penalty, and others that don't. No, I mean, when you're in that lifestyle, you abide by this subculture, the codes of this subculture, and it's really, really a sick thing to. You know, think back on now, because look, when I was in that lifestyle, I looked up to gangsters. I looked up to guys that had killed before, that commanded this sort of respect. And as appalling as that sort of sounds, we as a society we don't really understand that. I mean, I think we do. I think we do. You turn on the TV and you know you watch whatever you'll understand the subculture. I'm here to tell you that I don't, you know, some people, you know, transcend that. And I happen to be one of them. And I know a lot of other people that I'm around that have too. And you kind of look back on that and you not only feel bad for screwing your life up, you feel bad for taking a life that could have been so much more. And that's my case. And that's a lot of my peers' cases. So to answer your question, no, it's not about legislation that could prevent, you know, a subculture that persists. Look, there's people that don't have opportunities and that just grow up in a tough neighborhood, and or like myself, I grew up in a seedy parts of New York City.
Mm-hmm.
But it was very intoxicating, like that lifestyle. You know, how I think today, that's not. It's not intoxicating. It's disgusting, and I get it. It took me a while to get it,
yeah.
But I get it. The people I look up to today are Pulitzer Prize winning journalists. I mean, I look up to people like Bill Keller. Look up to the editors that you know. At
you have 1 minute left.
I look up to writers. You know, people that are.
So I mean, if there had been a teacher or, you know, a teacher or a family member or somebody who had gotten you early, do you think they could have pulled you out of that lifestyle?
Yeah, I want to answer that question. Can you repeat that question to me? I'll call you right back.
Yeah. Can you think of a teacher or somebody in your life who would have pulled you out of that lifestyle? And you're going to call me right back.
I'm going to answer that right now.
Okay.
Call you right
back. The caller has hung up.
Hello, John.
Hello.
Okay, so we're back and we're still rolling, and so I just repeat the question. You talked about how attractive the gang lifestyle was, and I'm asking, was there anybody in your life, a teacher, a family member, you grew up without a dad, if you'd had a father, that could have gotten you out of that life before you got into trouble?
You know, I mean, it's a great question, and it's like, you look, I mean, I've thought about that for years. I think where I am today, and I think about the impression that that what I'm doing today makes on others, for example. So I think if somebody made that look really, really fly and really cool, like publishing articles and being this journalist and, you know, wheeling and dealing with these kind of people, I mean, I probably would have been attracted to that. I probably would have wanted what he had, considering it was a he. I mean, that's not to take away from, you know, my own mother. My mother was a wheeler and dealer. She was a real estate broker. She wanted the best for me. She sent me to private school. So I don't want to sit here and seem like I didn't have opportunities, mm-hmm. because I did have opportunities, and I squandered them, you know, and that's something that I have to live with. And it's emotional, but, you know, I made a decision to pursue a pretty disgusting lifestyle while my mother watched and wept, you know. So
yeah.
It's, you know, I mean, I have to live with that. But when I went to prison, you know, she was very, very disappointed. And today, she's very proud.
Hmm. That's good. I also want to ask you, because you mentioned this in the Esquire piece, that at Attica, you sat at the, what'd you call it, the white boys table for when you when you're in the prison yard?
Yeah. So you know, prison is a little retro. Like, we haven't. It's still, you know, you sort of stick with, you know, your own kind in here, but that's not really how it is too much in New York compared to other prisons, especially out in California and in the Midwest. They're really on some race stuff in terms of segregating, self-segregating and all that, but we're not really on it too hard out here. But yes, in that yard, there were different tables, but I could just as easily go over and hang out with the Puerto Rican, the Jamaican. I mean,
I ask you because we're going through you know, I'm 66 now, so I remember the civil rights era, and I figured that by now we'd be past it and, you know, arguing over other things besides race. But if you follow any of the news on the outside, you know that we're in a full on race argument right now, it seems. And I'm just curious, from somebody who's got who lives in a community that is very integrated, and when you're this is up close and personal for you, you have any tips for us here on the outside?
Yeah, I mean it's we all. I mean, in Sing Sing, I learned about history, the Reconstruction, and as the minority in the classroom. So maybe try that. No,
I'm just that's right. You're a minority where you are.
But yes. So I mean, I know how it is to be a minority. So perhaps that sort of made me more empathetic, right? I remember I was in Attica learning about the Reconstruction and sharecropping, and just like this really tough period after that. And I remember being the sole white boy in the room, and like my friend Benny, this Dominican kid, he leans over, he's like John, he's like, good luck leaving class today. And it was just like, he was kidding, but it was just like this. I think he was giving me a nod, like it's cool, man. You know what I mean? Like, it, it was uncomfortable. It was discomforting, but it's just like sitting there and learning. How, like, I didn't know that stuff. Like, I didn't.
So you being schooled about your white privilege? Is that what I'm hearing?
I guess I was. Yeah. I mean, it was certainly quite an experience, and the experience goes on. I mean, I'm getting my bachelor's, at the end of this year, and I'm still the minority in the classroom, and we still have heated debates. And I remember I was in a class with Carl Hart. We were studying neuroscience, behavioral neuroscience. He's a Columbia professor. He's a pretty renowned guy. This guy's like the man. And we were talking about a lot of different things. He likes talking about, he sort of injects, fun conversations in the classroom. But somehow the gun debate came up, and one of the guys turned around and said, oh, that's a white people's problem. Like, and I was like, that's not a white. I mean, you hear it a lot when kids are shot in schools, and it's usually somebody says it's a crazy white boy that does that, and it's always mental illness when the white boy does it, but when guys like us do it, there's never that rationalization. So like, we had this big heated debate, and I had an opinion about that, but I was the sole white boy with the opinion, right, about that.
You gotta stick up for your race, huh?
It was just heated, and it was a interesting debate. I'm sure you'd like to be a fly on the wall.
As a
journalist, but it was interesting.
So I'm curious, you're in prison, you're getting all these famous professors teaching you stuff, and you're really into it. I mean, suppose somebody had showed up like that in your neighborhood. I mean, I don't know, did your drug gang have meetings? Suppose instead of, talking about which territory you're going to chart out, they sent a Columbia professor down there to get you jazzed on American history.
Yeah, so you're getting at mentorship, and how I think mentorship is very, very important, and I think I'm covering the graduation of these guys that are graduating with master's degrees, and there's a lot of talk of this word ministry in this graduate program that they're finishing up on the New York Theological Seminary. Mm-hmm. And they're all talking about this ministry of what the sort of pay it forward ministry. It's not necessarily, it comes from, religion, but not all of them are taking it that way, as they shouldn't, they shouldn't take it that way. That's what some of their professors have told them. And they've told me that a lot of the ministry is paying forward. So a lot of them are, that's a little texture there for the tape.
Uh-huh. What was he saying?
A lot of them are paint. No, the loudspeaker in the background. I was saying that was a little texture.
No, I know. I mean, what was the loudspeaker saying?
It was announcing a group to the barbershop.
Ah, gotcha. Okay, go on.
So they're talking about their ministries, these guys, and they're talking about paying it forward. So what they're going to do is they're going to mentor people. They're going to go home to their communities, or perhaps even in prison, and make education look fly. They're going to do the kind of thing that you were talking about that perhaps could have, changed my direction and a lot of other people's direction. But I'm a little. You know, I try not to rationalize with that, had dad been around or had there been this, because, I don't know, I had a pretty cool mom that, even though dad put a bullet in his head, I had a pretty cool mom that, she was a wheeler and dealer, and she told me I was dopey for selling drugs and breaking the law in America. Wow. She said there's plenty of ways to make a legitimate living, and it was a conscious decision that I made to continue to do that. And I'm accountable for that, and I live with that.
Yeah. Well, the only advice I can give to you at this point is to become friends with Kim Kardashian, and maybe get yourself a pardon or something. But it was a fascinating article in Esquire magazine. It's headlined "Inside Attica Correctional Facility and How Prisons Deal with Mental Health." You can Google that if you want to read the whole thing. Written by John J. Lennon, who is now serving possibly at least 11 years in Sing Sing. And John, thanks very much. I appreciate it very much.
I think it's titled "This Place Is Crazy" at Esquire magazine.
Let's see. According to the headline that is actually on the web is the one I read, "Inside Attica Correctional Facility." So if people were Googling it, that's what they'd have to look up.
Oh, okay. It's alternatively, this place is that's what it is in the print magazine, because it also came out in print.
Okay, so I'll say that then.
This place is crazy.
Also headline, okay. You might also find it under "This Place is Crazy," which is what the hard copy magazine says. John, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
All right, take care.
John.
Take care. Yes.